It's Wednesday, October 3rd, 2018, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Mike McKean and Ryan Thomas.
Amy.
On our program this week, President Trump's 80-minute tete-a-tete with the press, at times telling, at times downright bizarre. He said he was having so much fun he could keep going all day. If it was so much fun, why not have more of these open availabilities? The state of California passes its own net neutrality act, reinstating consumer protections for its residents after the federal government let Obama-era legislation lapse. The feds say that law isn't lawful, though, and has filed suit. And there's been yet another security breach at Facebook, this one affecting 50 million people worldwide, including at least one of us sitting at this table. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today. But we're going to start with a look back and a look forward at what happened last week and what's likely to happen tomorrow and Friday in D.C. The Kavanaugh hearings, Thursday morning, some riveting testimony that very emotional in the morning, very emotional in the afternoon, in very different ways.
And it was the media event that we were all predicting it was going to be. Ratings were huge. A lot of people talking about it. And the media's influence on the hearings, I think, was pretty interesting to talk about, too. Maybe we'll get into some of that.
Yeah, it was one of those where were you when moments. I heard a lot of people and I saw a lot of commentary comparing it to the Anita Hill testimony, for example, back in 1991. So certainly a sort of event television.
One of the things I noticed, and my schedule had changed from the time we talked about this last Wednesday and how we were going to try to make it our morning. My schedule changed and I couldn't as much, and I was in a waiting room somewhere, watching as much of it as I could unfold on Twitter. And one of the things that struck me was how vocally supportive of Blasey Ford that we saw journalists being in commenting on and supporting her in her testimony, and people coming back and saying, so these are supposedly independent journalists. These are people who aren't making decisions and are giving everybody the benefit of the doubt, yet look at how quickly they're coming to her support.
And I don't know to what extent that was, one, simply the fact that they believed her, mm-hmm. two, that they are cognizant of the Me Too moment and how they, you know, might be perceived if they didn't. I don't think it was just the words they spoke either. I mean, there was an interesting piece on our Links blog where the Washington Post looked at the Chiron's little graphics on the mm-hmm. lower third of the screen that sort of summarize what the newsrooms want you to know about what's being said or has been said. And with the possible exception of Fox News, for the cable channels, you could see that those Chirons are also, it seemed to be supportive in the sense that they were quoting her testimony 100% positive, lots of the words that she spoke. And I think that says something too about the way that news organizations felt like that her testimony was at the very least compelling, if not downright believable.
And I think as well, there's been a lot that's been written about news organizations and journalists who essentially brought her into the open against her wishes. She would prefer to remain anonymous. There's been stories of journalists showing up in her classroom, showing up at her house, pursuing a story. So I think there's the other side to that, which is the journalist involvement building up to, which may have informed the subsequent reaction.
And I don't know whether we'll actually ever know exactly who leaked what, but I did think that when she said that the media intimidated her into mm-hmm. coming forward, that said something about her own mindset. Mm-hmm. We don't really know who leaked the information to the media. Could have been somebody with the Senate. It could have been one of her friends that she talked to about it. We don't know, but clearly the practice of journalists sort of staking out perspective subjects for big stories is something that happens every single day. But in this particular circumstance, it makes us kind of have to reflect a little bit about whether or not we should be doing these kinds of stakeouts and what the rules of engagement are when we do them.
Well, and that's one of those things, too, that I bring up every time there is some kind of a mass casualty event and the public becomes very critical of how reporters use social media and Twitter specifically to reach out to sources. And is it that they're critical because they don't like the job that we're doing, or are they critical because they've never really seen the sausage be made before? Because we've been doing those things for decades, but technology has changed how transparent some of those practices may be.
There's a great piece on our Links blog from the Columbia Journalism Review that talks about, I think they refer to it as the routinization of pushing through the kind of natural human response to be empathetic and try to in search of the story in instances of trauma or mass casualties, natural disasters, all these sorts of things are of a kind of a similar nature here, and sort of wearing it almost as a sort of badge of honor, which I'm not quite sure on that part, but certainly the first part. I'd hope that we as a field and as a profession sort of made progress on this front, but perhaps not. I'm not sure.
There was another positive aspect of the media coverage. I don't know that it really, you know, that the media can take credit for anything more than turning on the cameras, so to speak. But we found that the National Sexual Assault Hotline got something like 150% of the calls that they would get on that same day that was going on. C-SPAN, which during the breaks was having call-ins, like they said, like every other call was a woman calling in to share her own experience with sexual assault or abuse. And so there were some positive aspects of the coverage, just having the cameras on in that kind of historic moment.
The story hasn't gone away this week as we await, you know, the end and the conclusion of the FBI investigation and what happens next with the subsequent vote. And in some ways, it's even turned to bizarre moments waiting for the band UB40 to respond to the fact that there was a bar fight that may have been started as while the song Red Red Wine was playing. Like, the reporting is still developing about other potential incidents.
Which brings us around to, again, we say lots of times on this show that a couple of different things can be true at the same time. Mm-hmm. So we've had Republicans who were opposed to having the FBI continue the investigation because it was just another week or whatever for more drip, drip, drip. And that's exactly what is happening, although the stories don't necessarily seem to be quite as heavy as the ones that came before it. But also you have the narrative of 1 week is not enough time to really dig into this story. Looks like that's turning out to be true, too, from everything we're seeing about efforts to, you know, rein in the investigation, to who has or has not yet been interviewed. So both of those narratives from the Democrats and the Republicans, there's some truth to each one of them, I think.
There's also something a little bit icky, technical term, of about cable news pundits sort of scoring this like they would a sort of heavyweight boxing match in terms of the testimonies that were given and so on. Did they land a blow here? It's all that sort of language. And then the sort of horse race coverage about what will this mean for a certain Senate seat for in West Virginia or Missouri. And while I accept that those stories have to be told, I do worry that about them being told too much.
Do they have to be told, though, or is that just a way to fill the dead air during this week while we're waiting for the next incremental development? It's just kind of some way to keep people talking about something.
Well, let me rephrase that. They are a story that can be told. And I think there are obvious political implications here because Claire McCaskill, the senator from West Virginia, is another example of senators who haven't sort of come out yet, or maybe McCaskill has, I'm not sure. But in any case, covering the political implications of it are an eventual story, I imagine, but maybe they shouldn't be first and foremost.
Mike, you had also mentioned you'd hope to talk a little bit about the influence that the media had had. We have a lot of video clips we're going to be playing during today's show, so I thought I would restrain myself on this one. But the Saturday Night Live cold open with Matt Damon playing Brett Kavanaugh there were some laughs in there. There was what felt to me to be the right amount of levity, but too much too soon.
No, I mean, this is what they've done well to sort of resurrect their brand over the past couple of years since Trump has been elected president. And I thought that, you know, Matt Damon did a really good job of impersonating Brett Kavanaugh from the sniffs and the drinking the water and all the stuff. It seemed like it hewed pretty close to home. I think I would give them credit for finding the moment and not exploiting it more than they otherwise normally would do.
I thought it struck the right note as well. It was a funny sketch. I was worried there would be an opportunity for Alec Baldwin to wheel out his Donald Trump impression, which I'm not a huge fan of. But that kind of skit where you had a Trump character sort of mocking it, or a skit that would mock her testimony particularly, may cross the line. But I thought they played it just right.
You know, there was one other aspect of this whole thing that really interests me, and that's, in some senses, the divide between journalists and their audiences over whether or not Jeff Flake and Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski should be praised or not praised for extending the deadline and holding off the vote. I mean, the media coverage, the main framing of that was, look at what a hero is Flake standing up to his party. He and the other two senators who haven't yet announced how they're going to vote, they managed to force this 5-day or 6-day investigation by the FBI. And yet, if you look at comments on like the New York Times website and some other places, the vast majority of the audience was just saying, no, they're going to vote for him anyway, or they didn't cause a long enough delay to do a real investigation. So they're not really giving them the benefit of the doubt for trying to put together some sort of compromise.
Well, and, you know, Flake the hero, who's not running for re-election, who, had he been running for re-election, may have acted very differently to maintain the support of his Republican base.
Oh, yes, he said as much in an interview this week. He said if he was running for election, he would not have done it. So, I mean, that's quite sad moment for American democracy.
Yeah. Well, the president hasn't been shy about answering reporters' questions about this and other things in the past week. Going back to last Wednesday's 80-minute news conference following his address at the UN Security Council, that one had some moments that, frankly, gave Jimmy Kimmel the material for his entire monologue Wednesday night. His conclusion? That 80 minutes at the podium was successful.
This press conference was successful only in that he did not physically melt or explode during it. The craziest part is I bet he thinks he nailed it. Right now, I bet he's sitting in bed eating a celebratory box of the Colonel's Extra Crispy going and wiping his hands on the sheets, you know?
So some of the highlights, the claim that the Democrats wouldn't have accepted George Washington as his Supreme Court nominee, and that the leaders who laughed during his speech at the UN were laughing with him. It was, let's just say, it was a lot. And wouldn't you know, it took until 20 minutes into that news conference for the president to call on a woman, and it didn't happen until CNN's Jim Acosta asked this.
If you don't mind, after I'm finished, if Ouija or Hallie or Vivian or one of our female colleagues could go after me, that would be great. Mr. President, just to follow up on these allegations against Brett Kavanaugh.
What does he mean by that? Explain. What does that mean?
I think it would be great if a female.
What does it mean? What does it mean?
It would be great if a female reporter would ask you a question about this issue. So if you don't mind,
I wouldn't mind that at all. No, wouldn't mind it at all.
All right. Well, let me.
Wouldn't make any difference to me.
So Hallie Jackson did ask the next few questions after that, and she did get around to asking about Kavanaugh. That's part of what led to that bizarre response about George Washington perhaps having a shady past with women. And when she did, he answered. And then started sparring with her a little bit, making jokes and then opening up. The tone of it, this whole 80 minutes, the tone of it was just bizarre.
It was oddly theatrical. I think in a strange way, he came across like he was enjoying it at times, because I think he got to sort of demonstrate the kind of pugilistic take on the media style that has become his stock in trade. There was a question where a Reuters correspondent was asking a question. He said, give it to me, Reuters, you know. And he also sort of demonstrated that he's very savvy about knowing how the media world operates, in the sense of sort of following major developments. Like, he congratulated a Sky News correspondent on their takeover by Comcast. He follows these things very closely. So I thought it played to some of his strengths in that regard. Now, whether that's a good thing for the presidency, for American democracy, is a different question, but in terms of the theatrics, I thought it played to his strengths.
Yeah, I mean, he's able to compartmentalize. I mean, you know, he can say that we're the enemies of the American people, that he hates the press, and he can turn around and he can call people out by name and spar with them, and he enjoys that. I do think that when he started interacting with some of the women journalists, including Cecilia Varga,
yeah,
from
we're going to
ABC
talk about
News,
that in a second, because that
was
in a separate,
really something.
Yeah, so that was in a separate event. That one actually happened this Monday. What happened is that Cecilia Vargas was about to ask a question, and It resulted in a change to the official transcript that the White House issued after Monday's event. Take a listen to this exchange and listen to what the president said after calling on ABC reporter Cecilia Vega.
She's shocked that I picked her.
No.
She's like in a state of shock.
I'm not thinking, Mr.
That's
president.
That's okay. I know you're not thinking. You never do.
So I have to ask you, what did you hear? Thinking or thinking?
Thinking.
Thinking.
And so the transcript comes back and says that it's thanking. You're just kind of biting your lip, Mike. Go ahead.
Well, thanking wouldn't make... I mean, a lot of this doesn't make sense, right? So let's put that on the table. But thanking wouldn't make sense in the context of the sentence. I mean, if you look at the sort of flow of the dialogue, it seemed clear to me that it was thinking in the context of an insult to the reporter. That's how I interpreted it.
And those kinds of insults are routine. Okay. He insults men and women from the press corps all the time, but there was an awful sharp focus on that because of the subject matter, you know, the people were asking him questions about, and he stepped in it.
Well, and that's where it keeps coming back to this, too. So the ABC reporter, Caitlin Collins, talking a minute ago about what happened with Hallie Jackson, because he also came back on her after, you know, asking three or four questions, like, are you done yet? Some of this, it's starting to seem or feel like he's having a problem that's even bigger with women who are asking him about the Kavanaugh situation.
Well, there is a pattern of behavior here, which is interesting. I mean, prior to the presidency, he had a conflict with Megyn Kelly, Mika Brzezinski. And whilst it's certainly true that he is or can be hostile to journalists across the board, there is a sort of gendered element to this, and the optics of having a group of men, I think, except for one woman in that crowd, sort of laughing at his jokes while he mocked a female reporter is pretty nasty.
Okay, well, so let's change gears just a little bit. I thought it was a little strange the other day. I picked up my phone and Facebook logged me out, both of the Facebook app and of the Messenger app. It was odd, but I re-entered my password and logged back on and went about with my day. It wasn't until the next morning I found out it was because I was among the 50 million people worldwide who'd been subject to the latest security breach. So just when I thought I was special, there's 50 million of us. And Ryan, you told me once you heard about that you were logged out too.
I was one of the 50 million as well. And I keep my passwords on a printed sheet of paper in my house because I'm from the 19th century. And so I was also without Facebook for an entire day. So solidarity.
Oh, Ryan.
Okay. I don't know if I got logged out or not. Maybe it was a senior moment I don't remember. But I think I might not have been one of the 50 million.
Well, so at first when this happened, I didn't think much of it. And it isn't until later that we find out it was because Facebook had basically enacted a patch and logged everybody out so that they could log themselves back in before they made it clear that there had been a problem. Does that strike you as...
It depends on how much time passed between finding out the problem and fixing the problem. Yeah. If they were able to patch it quickly, good for them. If they held it, like, you know, we've seen lots of examples of data, you know, getting out and companies waiting forever and ever to tell their customers about it, that would be bad. The thing for Facebook, of course, is no matter whether they were doing it quickly or not, the timing couldn't have been worse for them. I mean, they're still reeling from the Cambridge Analytica scandal. They've got regulators in the EU and the US who are breathing down their neck about privacy and a lot of other and fomenting disinformation. So this is a bad time for yet another problem to crop up for them.
You bring up the EU, and because of differences in internet privacy laws there, Facebook is now facing, and I want to make sure that I look at the exact numbers. I want to say there was something like 1.6 million. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a fine of, I think it's a couple, because, oh no, I don't have the exact numbers, so forgive me for that. But I think 5 million of the people affected were in the EU, and as a result, they're looking at a very, very hefty fine because of this.
1.63 billion Thank was the number you. That I saw Thank quoted, you. Which was identified as 4% of its annual revenue. So it's not quite a drop in the ocean, but maybe it is enough to make them sit up and take notice. I think it's helpful to keep in mind that we're dealing with two very different sort of regulatory regimes here, where the EU and Europe is much more in favor of regulation than the United States. And so it'll be interesting to see the outcome of this. If they want to avoid EU fines in the future, Then
they need to get their act together.
Well, then they might, because they would want a uniform user experience in the US rather than have different user experiences. So in some ways, the EU may take a leadership role in this.
I don't want to sound like an apologist for Facebook, but look at the irony of the three exploits that the hackers used. One was through a tool that was meant to help upload your birthday videos more easily. And two of them were actually changes that they'd made in their software to protect your privacy better. And instead, they got hacked.
One of the interesting things, there was a piece I added to our links blog early this morning. New York Times' technology columnist warning people that because of these types of data breaches, if you're logging into other sites, like for instance, my Chicago Tribune subscription I log into most often using my Facebook, that the breach could actually also translate to other places where you're using Facebook single sign-on or authentication, and to maybe start making additional passwords for your list.
maybe. Point noted.
Okay. So let's turn to California, where a couple of new laws went into effect this week that have people across the country wondering if they're legal. Like, there's one that says publicly traded companies based in that state must have at least one woman on the board of directors, and a net neutrality law giving consumers there the protections that the federal government restricted, allowing internet service providers to throttle speeds, to limit the exposure of tech companies like Etsy, smaller ones in favor of the internet service providers like Verizon, like Comcast. This California law, what exactly does it prohibit? What does it what does it allow for?
Well, it prohibits broadband and wireless companies from blocking, throttling, or hindering access to internet content, from favoring some websites, from charging more for faster speeds, and so it reinstates in the state of California the Obama-era net neutrality protections, and there are some very, very technical measures in which it goes beyond that. And so this is the first state to have this sort of enhanced law. I think Vermont and Oregon and Washington State have tried in the past, but California is the first to sort of bring all this together, and it's attracted a lot of attention and a lobbying campaign by the telecoms industry to defeat the bill.
So I'm not exactly a interstate commerce expert, but federal government is not happy about this, has already sued to enjoin the law, and Ajit Pai says that the chair of the FCC says this is not legal.
And the telecom companies are arguing the same thing, that there needs to be one law across the land for regulating or not regulating the internet service providers. And here's California stepping in, and this sort of piecemeal state-by-state approach could have problems. It's funny, though, because the same folks who will argue that we need to have one common federal solution for a public policy issue like that will turn around and say just the exact opposite thing when it's an issue like, say, abortion rights. Oh, states ought to make up their own rules, and, you know, and instead of having one Supreme Court rule that guides us. So there's some kind of strange bedfellows here on wanting to have the federal government stand up for consumer protection of the internet.
On a general abstract level, I mean, I think it makes sense to have a uniform federal approach, because this kind of crazy quilt of different regimes in different states where your rights as an internet consumer are different. But that is true in some ways to the architecture of American governance, where power is sort of separated and devolved. What will be interesting is if this law stands, if it isn't struck down. I mean, California is a populous state, and so the telecoms companies may decide to comply. I mean, we don't know yet, but it may then become a model. But we'll see. We'll have to follow it in the court system.
Okay. Well, before we go, there are a few pop culture stories to bring to your attention. Let's start by taking a listen to this. So that's the opening of Taurus by the band Spirit. Maybe you thought it sounded a bit like the opening riff of Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven. you wouldn't be alone. And that's why there's about to be another copyright infringement case starting up. This is going back to court. We talked about this a couple of years ago, and now that case is, or that decision's being thrown out.
There was a lower court judge who'd held a, who presided over a trial where a jury found that Led Zeppelin had not infringed on the band's copyright. But now a federal appeals court panel has said, well, but wait a minute, the judge gave some faulty instructions to the jury that might have led them to come to that conclusion, so they're going to reopen the trial. I don't know. I guess we'll see Jimmy Page and Robert Plant testifying again, and whether they can overcome the concerns about what is clearly, in some ways, a very similar sound in the two songs.
I think the ruling sort of inferred that the previous standard was too stringent, in the sense that it had to match every single individual note. And what the new guideline may be is look at it as a totality, a sort of sounds like, a sort of smells like a test.
Well, and if it's something that you at home want to take a listen to, make sure you check out our links blog at kbia.org, because the video and audio clip that we have posted on there has the two back to back all in a single clip, so you can listen to it. Kind of a neat announcement about a show with a bit of a cult following. So Black Mirror is kind of like a 21st century Twilight Zone, though each episode centers on the impact technology has on our lives. The title, Black Mirror, refers to the screens we rely on so heavily, phones, watches, laptops. A twist is coming for season 5. There's going to be an episode with interactivity. Choose your own adventure type of thing.
I haven't seen Black Mirror yet. I'm behind the curve there. But I loved the Choose Your Own Adventure books. And so I like the idea that the user, the viewer, can shape their own viewing experience. What's particularly interesting is that because this is a show that focuses on the consequences of technology, the viewer then may be prompted to think of the moral consequences of their choices for the characters within a narrative. That's a very clever thing to do, and a very sort of way to humanize that.
Yeah, I have enjoyed Black Mirror and can't wait for the next season to drop in December, but I'm not quite sure how this is going to work. I mean, Netflix and others have experimented with a sort of choose your own adventure format with some other kinds of programming, but this is a very expensive and very complicated set of stories that they tell. How exactly are they going to fill different endings? And I do think it is intriguing, as you say, Ryan, that, you know, considering what the show is all about, it could cause us to contemplate what our own role is in the technologies that affect us. But that's going to be a very, I think, difficult thing to pull off. I don't doubt that the creators of Black Mirror can pull it off. It's a great show, but I'm going to be curious to see what it actually looks like.
Well, and I am too. And I have this bad feeling too, that once I watch that one outcome, I'm going to go back and watch it again.
For
and
sure.
I'm going to go back and watch it again and check out each of them. Well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog under the programs tab on kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music, and Ellie Fitzgerald is our social media producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.